So last week we introduced the section in Matthew chapter 10, starting from verse 24, and I wanted to communicate to you, how do we understand what it means to be a Christian? You know, what does it mean to be a disciple of Christ? There's so many people who claim to be Christians, but if we were to ask them, how do you define being a Christian, we might find out that their definition really is something of their own making. It's not actually from the Word of God, it's actually not from Christ Himself. And if anyone should be able to define what it means to follow Him, shouldn't it be Jesus Himself? This might be the reason why a lot of people are confused about Christianity. Because when you say, I'm a Christian, that can mean so many things to people. And that's because people tend to go with their own opinions, their own ideas. That's why it's so important for us to look to the Word of God and have a proper understanding. And especially, last week we talked about when Jesus says something, do we really take that to heart? I mean, it's not something that we can just easily dismiss, especially when it comes to defining things. Last week we looked at verses 24, 25, that a true disciple of Christ seeks to become like his teacher. And we should also understand that we're not going to be treated any better than the teacher or the master. And so if Jesus himself was called Satan, and that everything he did was because he had the power of demons, we shouldn't be surprised if people would maybe insult us or say those sorts of things, make false accusations. If anything, we should see that in our calling to follow Christ, to suffer in these ways is actually a confirmation. It's an affirmation of our salvation. In Philippians 1, verse 27 and following, it says this, "Only conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind striving together for the faith of the gospel, in no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction for them, but of salvation for you, and that too from God. For to you it has been granted for Christ's sake not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, experiencing the same conflict which you saw in me and now hear to be in me." Now I think when we hear that there is some suffering involved in being a Christian, or that there's going to be maybe some sort of opposition, or people are not going to treat you well, does anyone like that? I mean, does anyone like being mocked or maligned? I don't think so. I don't think anyone here would invite suffering or persecution upon themselves. I mean, why would you? But if there's a distinctive that I think we have to take seriously, if you follow Jesus Christ, you should not be surprised that there is opposition, that there is suffering, that there is hardship. I think too many people kind of have this idea that if you're going to be a Christian, God just wants to make you happy and give you everything you want. That is not what the Bible teaches. Now, it's not that God doesn't want you happy. If there's anyone who really is going to help you truly be happy, it's going to be God. And if there's anyone that's going to really give you fulfillment and blessing, it's going to be God. But it might not be on the kind of terms that we like. In fact, a lot of us maybe place terms on God, and if he doesn't come through, we get upset with him, or we blame him for things. When in fact, if we just looked at his word, we shouldn't be surprised by certain things. So, in following the outline of this passage, we're going to look at the second main portion, verses 26 to 31, and it is this, "The disciple does not fear anyone but God." Let's look at it, starting from verse 26 in Matthew 10. "Therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light, and what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered, so do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows. So Jesus is following up what he's just talked about. He said, you know, there are going to be those people who malign you. I mean, if they call the head of the household Beelzebul, verse 25, how much more will they malign the members of his household? Now, three times in verses 26 to 31, Jesus says, do not fear. In verse 26, he says, therefore, do not fear. Verse 28, do not fear. Verse 31, so do not fear. So I don't think you have to be a biblical theologian scholar to figure out if someone says something three times, what does that mean? It might be a little important. It might be actually significant for us to consider. Why does Jesus say, do not fear? Well, early in the chapter, when Jesus tells his disciples and sends them out to do the work of the gospel ministry, he says, I'm sending you like sheep in the midst of wolves, right? Verse 16. And then he says, men are going to hand you over to the courts. You're going to be scourged in the synagogues. You're going to be whipped. You're going to be physically beaten and tortured. You're going to be thrown before governors and kings. You're going to be betrayed by your family members. And then he says, you will be hated by all. You'll be persecuted from city to city, not to mention that you will be maligned. Now, I don't know, you know, say we had a church meeting and we said, all right, church, we want you to come together and we're gonna do some things for God. But let me just caution you, this is what's gonna happen, okay? If you're, let's say we have a missions team and we're gonna say, we're going to such and such a country and the people there are brutal, we might get arrested, we might get tortured and beaten, we might get murdered. Okay, who wants to sign up for that mission trip? Yeah, I don't know how many people would be excited for that mission trip, right? Because you're like, I kind of like to live, and that doesn't sound so appealing. And if Jesus is trying to kind of give a pep talk to his disciples here, right, as he's about to send them out, don't you think they should probably receive a little bit more, I don't know, encouragement? I mean, why focus on all these things that seem so hard? Well, we're going to talk about that today. But if you look throughout the ministry of Jesus with his disciples in the gospel accounts, there are numerous times that the disciples were afraid. And Jesus had to remind them, don't be afraid. Do not fear. For instance, in Matthew 14, starting from verse 22, it says, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. After he sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountains by himself to pray. And when it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already a long distance from the land, battered by the waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking the sea, they were terrified and said, it is a ghost. And they cried out in fear. Okay, just stop right there. We read that and we're like, yeah, that's the story of Jesus walking in the water. Now, if you were actually there, okay, and you're on this boat and there's a storm and the boat's getting rocked, Jesus isn't with you because he went up to pray somewhere, and then all of a sudden you see someone walking on the water. What would you think? I think most of us would think, okay, this is pretty freaky, right? I mean, stuff like this is not supposed to happen. I mean, this is like a horror movie almost, right? It looks like a ghost is coming to us. And just think of the scene. Boat, storm, they're scared, ghost. What do you think is going to happen? You're going to die. You're going to die, right? Because whoever this thing is going to come and destroy you. I mean, you can't help but think that way. But then Jesus, in verse 27, says, but immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid. Now, if you hear those words, should they bring some measure of comfort to you? Confidence? I mean, especially given the circumstances? Now, this is where we get to see Peter, okay? Peter, the impetuous one, right? So immediately, how does he respond? Peter said to him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." I mean, this is pretty interesting. Peter says, "If it's you, Jesus, tell me to come out and let me walk on the water too." Now, he's pretty bold, right? But I don't know. What do you think he was expecting? I don't know. But Jesus says, "Come. Come." Now, what would you do if you, especially those of you who are very rational, very logical, very scientific, you know, you're someone who reasons through everything, and Jesus says, "Come," and you think, "So am I about to walk on water?" Now, how many of you have ever tried walking on water? Well, I mean, water like 1 inch high doesn't count. Okay, we're talking about go out to the ocean where it's pretty deep. Try walking on that. You're not gonna be able to make it. But it says here, Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. Now, for all that Peter did, all the times that he messed up, he had some pretty cool experiences. This has got to be one of them. He's actually walking on water. Now, still, remember, there's a storm going on. Jesus is out there on the water. You can imagine all the disciples are like, "I should have asked," right? I mean, you know, it's a crazy scene. But seeing the wind, he became frightened. Now, what did Jesus just say right before this? "Don't be afraid." But why does he say, "Don't be afraid"? He says, "Take courage. It is I. You shouldn't fear when I'm here with you." But Peter, seeing the wind, he became frightened, began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus stretched out his hand and took hold of him and said to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind stopped, and those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "You are certainly God's son." Now, if you read that story, you go, so how do they deal with the fear factor involved here? I mean, this is pretty crazy. This is a storm. I've been out on a boat in the ocean when it got pretty choppy, and it's kind of scary. It's really scary. When you are so far away from land, I mean, I can swim, but I can't swim that far. And you're thinking, if this boat goes down, it's over. I mean, there's a certain terror that kind of starts to... You feel it in your heart. So we can understand why the disciples are afraid. But here Jesus says, "Do not be afraid." Jump over to Matthew 28. Another scene, starting from verse 8. This is after the resurrection takes place. It says, "And they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to report it to his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and greeted them. And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said, 'Do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me.'" Now, why does Jesus again say, "Do not be afraid"? Well, it's understandable. The disciples have just seen Jesus crucified. I mean, everything that they had hoped for was crushed. And they know that because they were his followers, they were next, right? I mean, if you follow Jesus and they're going to kill him, they're going to kill his followers too. Now, Jesus meets them and greets them. This is the, like, ultimate meet and greet, right? Jesus comes and says, "Hey, I'm alive." And he says, "I have some work for you to do. But don't be afraid." Go over to Luke 12, verse 31. And this is the parallel account where in Matthew 6, 33, if you remember, Jesus says, "Seek first his kingdom." In Luke 12, 31, it says, "But seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you." Then look at verse 32. "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom." Now, Jesus was trying to assure them, Don't be anxious. Don't worry. God's going to take care of your daily needs. He takes care of the birds of the sky, the flowers of the field. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Go over to John 14, verse 27, and this is in the upper room. Remember, Jesus is with his disciples the night before he is crucified. He says, "Peace I leave with you," John 14, 27, "my peace I give to you, not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful." Now, I think if there's one thing that we can know about the disciples, they were fearful. They were afraid. They were anxious because they were human, just like us. I mean, we are fearful people. And we, I think, are especially fearful, not only in terms of difficult circumstances, but we're fearful about what people think of us. There is the harsh reality that there are people who will gossip, who will slander, who will make false accusations about you, especially in relation to you being a Christian. Now, I don't know anyone who appreciates this. No one likes this. But I think it's especially hard to swallow when you see people who seem to get away with gossiping, slandering, insulting, accusing, especially people who are innocent of the things that they're being accused of, but their reputations are ruined. And then we wonder, is there any justice? I think that's why we as Christians struggle with fear. We fear what people think. We fear what people say. We fear that people will get away with treating Christians badly. Now, if there's one thing that I could tell you that I relate to, it's that. It's really that. You know, I thought in becoming a pastor, I'm serving God, right? And in serving God, and you're going to love people and care for them, you think that what's going to come back is people are going to appreciate that. They might even say thank you. They will hopefully respond positively. Now, I do vaguely remember in seminary and even growing up at church, yeah, sometimes they're suffering and sometimes people do bad things, but I didn't think it would happen to me. I didn't think it would happen to me. That stuff happens to other people. But I still remember very vividly the first time, and the sad thing about this is it's not from the world so much, it's from the religious establishment. It's from the church. That's the crazy thing about this. In fact, if you remember Jesus, who does he receive the greatest, you know, persecution from? The Pharisees, the scribes, the religious folks, right? You didn't expect that. You think of all people that the religious folks are supposed to get this. In our context, it would be the churchgoers, right? Like our church family. And we don't anticipate this. In fact, if you're like me, you get kind of shocked by it. Like, say hi to your neighbor right now. Just say hi. Just say hi. Hi. Just a hi. It's just a hi, right? And then say hi back. It's okay. Don't worry. We're not doing anything like weird. Just say hi, okay? And most of the people, when we say hi, we're like, oh, they seem nice. They seem nice. Hi. We might even go a step further and say, hi, brother. Ooh, brother. Or hi, sister. We're like family. We're like a church family. And you might even start to have conversations with fellow church members, right? And you think along the way, oh, such nice people. Such nice people. We go out to eat together after church. Maybe we even serve on a ministry team together. Like we're working on the nursery team. We're taking care of the babies together or the children. And you think all is good. But what you don't know is that there are things going on behind the scenes. People are talking. And they're not talking good things. They're talking about the things they don't like about you. They're thinking about the things that bother them about you. Sometimes it's silly stuff. Sometimes it's such petty stuff. But it's interesting that there are folks who actually will go out of their way to think badly of you, and not only that, to talk badly about you. And they will spread that to others within the church. Now, I suppose being a pastor, I get exposed to more opportunities for this. And sometimes it's kind of shocking. It's shocking when a church member that I saw every Sunday that smiled and said, "Hi, Pastor," and this and that, and then we're in the office and they are screaming and yelling at me and saying all sorts of crazy stuff like to my face. And in my mind, I almost feel like this is an out-of-body experience. I'm like, what's going on? They were so nice. And now they're screaming. they're threatening. You know, I mean, it's crazy the things people will say and do. You know, I remember after I left Maryland and came back to Southern Cal, and I'd run into people, you know, every once in a while who would say, "Oh, I heard what happened." And I'm thinking, what did they hear? Because I wasn't talking to anybody. Said, "I heard," one story was, "I heard you got confronted about your sermons being too long. And you were asked to shorten them and you refused. So you got fired." And I thought, okay, the long sermon thing, I get. Okay? But no, that's not what happened. I didn't get fired because of my long sermons. But my question was, "And you believe that?" And they're like, "Well, that's what I heard." I go, "You just believe what anyone says?" And I'm like, "I don't get that. Wow." And in my mind, all I was thinking was like, "So you just believe whatever people say. I hate you." It was a quick jump. You know, it's like, why would I want to hang around someone like you? Like you say you know me, you say you're my friend, and then you go that direction with that? Well, I think what I failed to remember at that time is that Jesus said it could be like this. People will malign you. People will accuse you. People will mock you for following him. Now, I'm not saying I did everything so great either. But in responding to those kind of situations, how many of us then are fearful about then what it means to follow Christ? Because if it means that people are going to treat me this way, why would I want to go down a path that ends up with people treating me this way? We're fearful then that people are going to get away with stuff like that. And that's what I struggled with. I remember thinking, like, people are spreading lies, they're slandering, and no one's saying anything to defend me. I must say something, I tell my wife. And she'd say, "Don't do it. Don't do it. Let God vindicate you." Like, but nothing's happening. I think I need to say something. Well, I learned a good lesson at that time. Don't do it. Don't do it. First of all, you're not going to even change people's minds anyway. But what's the motivation behind this? What it is, it's a fear of man. It's a fear of man. You know, if there's anything you should not fear, you should not fear what man can do. Go back to Matthew 10:26. Jesus says, "Therefore, do not fear them." Who's the them? The people who malign. Now, just in case you think that they're going to get away with it, Jesus says this, "For there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known." You know what? Everything is going to be revealed. Everything. You know, some people think, well, what if they get away with it? No, they're not going to get away with it. First of all, God knows. But not only does God know, God will reveal it. Jump over to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. This is toward the end of the book. Solomon, he writes these words. The conclusion, verse 13, Ecclesiastes 12:13. The conclusion when all has been heard, it is this: fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. You know, I think sometimes we really don't believe that. We're actually more concerned that people are going to get away with things. And Jesus says, you know what? Don't fear those kind of people, because they will be revealed for all that they do. Do we trust this? In fact, if anything, do we trust God when he says, do not fear? This is a promise. Don't fear, because God is going to make everything right. God is especially going to vindicate. But do you believe that? I remember having a hard time believing that, because I didn't see it happen immediately. Like, I wanted to see it happen now. Right? If someone does something wrong, they should pay for it. They should be confronted with it. Now, this is where it really is maybe challenging for us to truly accept. In being a true disciple of Christ, do you understand that there will be times where people will malign you, insult you, falsely accuse you, because you are a Christian, because you love Christ? And people will do ugly things. People that you once trusted will betray you. And they will go to great lengths to do everything they can to tear down your character. But that's what happened to Jesus. We shouldn't be surprised. And if anything, that really we should be drawn to is this: God has revealed to us truth. In verse 27, it says, "What I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light, and what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops." And what Jesus is trying to say here is this: you know what? Just in case you kind of are fearful about all these things that I'm telling you about and all these things that I represent, don't be afraid. In fact, boldly proclaim it. Believe the promises of God that he gives to us. You know, the idea back then of proclaiming upon your housetops, people at that time, if you wanted to announce something, like say you wanted to make an announcement to your village, you'd go to the top of your house and you'd be like, "Announcement! My daughter's getting married!" And everyone like, "Oh, okay." I mean, they didn't have microphones and sound systems and all that. You just went to the housetop and you would announce it. You would speak forth. Now, what are we called to speak forth? What Jesus tells us. You know, there's a sense where Jesus, especially when he was talking with his disciples, he'd be teaching them privately. He'd be telling them in the close context of, you know, just the time that he spent with them. He said, you know what? Instead of being fearful of what people are going to do to you, you keep boldly proclaiming the truth. You go out there, and you know what? Don't be afraid. Because in verse 28, it says, "Do not fear those who kill the body." Now, stop right there. He's essentially saying, don't be afraid of proclaiming the truth, because what's the worst they could do to you? What's the worst they could do? The worst they could do is kill your body. Kill your body. But they are not able to kill your soul. Now, that's a big difference. Why is that a big deal? Now, I think anytime we hear about like this sort of thing where if you knew that your life was at stake for doing something, would you just easily kind of go into that situation? Probably not. But Jesus is saying, you know what? You don't need to fear, because the worst man can do to you is kill your body. Now, I don't think any of us wants that to happen, at least right away. You know, I would think if you want to kill my body, my body's already almost there. You know, you can just like, it's like give the final flick of the finger. It'll take me out. Please do. I'd welcome it. But here Jesus is saying this. You don't need to be afraid of man in any way. Because what can they do? They can kill you, but they can't kill your soul. If there's anyone you should fear, you should fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Now, those are serious words to consider. Now, I'm talking to you as a Christian. Okay? There's some words relevant to the non-Christian as well. But you shouldn't be afraid about people who ultimately can't do anything to affect your eternal destiny. They can't do anything about that. They can't take that away from you. But you should remember there's someone greater. There is a God who is final judge and the one who has the authority and the ability to destroy your body and soul in hell. Now, before we kind of get into all that, we still have to deal with this. But as a Christian, it's hard, right? It's hard when times are difficult and when there are evil people, wicked people who do wicked things, and they make life very difficult. Well, this is not new. The book of Psalms really highlights how we should respond. Turn to Psalm 23, verse 4. Psalm 23, verse 4. This is part of the well-known, you know, Shepherd's Psalm. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. We sang a song that had those very words. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. A couple summers ago, we went through Psalm 23, if you remember. And this is a very comforting truth. It doesn't take away from the reality that there are times where you're walking through the valley of the shadow of death. There are some hard times that come in life. But we do not have to fear evil. Why? Because God is with us. God is with us. Remember when the disciples were on the sea and on the boat, and he says, "Take courage, it is I." Where did they find their comfort and strength? Where were they able to deal with their fear? Because Christ was with them. Psalm 27, verse 1, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? When evildoers came upon me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and my enemies, they stumbled and fell. Though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. Though war arise against me, in spite of this, I shall be confident." Now, if there's one thing that's very, very difficult to do in terms of real life, all right, when there are evildoers, adversaries, and enemies, and they, in a sense, encompass you, I mean, they surround you, and they are really pushing, you know, they're pressuring you with all that they're saying and doing, how do you respond to that? You know, over the years, being a pastor, I mean, there have been times where, yeah, physically, it was just very real that there were enemies in front of me. And, you know, it's not a movie. It's not just theory. It's reality. And I'm afraid someone's going to hit me. You know, I mean, it's just very real. How do you respond? Well, you got to ask that question in verse 1. "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread?" I mean, talk about who's my defender. Who is defending me? I mean, we're not talking about like comic book heroes here. We're talking about the God of the universe is my defender. Psalm 34:9. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for to those who fear him there is no want. Do you understand? If you really fear God and you don't fear man, it's kind of like Psalm 23, verse 1. It says, the Lord is my shepherd. Shepherd, I shall not want. If I fear the Lord, there is no want. There's nothing I need. Psalm 46, verse 1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Though the earth should change, and though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains quake at its swelling pride. I mean, think about it. If the whole earth were like shaking around you, and you're like, what in the world is going on? You don't have to fear. You know, I was reading this text right before I went to bed, and I had a pretty crazy dream. It just seemed so real. I remember I was in a house with a family, and then the house started tilting, and we were falling. Like, there was an earthquake, and our house was falling. And I see my whole family. We're all just falling. And I just remember screaming out, we're going to go see Jesus! And then I woke up, like, suddenly, and I just, in my bed, I was like, no! Oh! And I was like, oh, that felt so real. And I was just thinking, like, oh, okay. Like, how do I go back to sleep? And I'm like, okay, this is too much. This is like kind of stressful. Like, I want to rest during my sleep, but I'm just thinking about all these things, right? Like, life is crazy sometimes. Okay, don't read too much into the dream. It's just a dream. But, you know, sometimes when you're dreaming, it's because you're thinking about stuff that's been on your heart, right? On your mind. And I remember thinking, like, looking back, I mean, life's kind of crazy. Life's kind of crazy. And I was actually kind of thankful that my first reaction to that was, we're going to go see Jesus, you know. And that's what I was telling my family. But we're here. We're still here. But we don't need to fear. And this is to the extent. This is why I love the imagery here. Though the earth should change, though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains quake at its swelling pride. You don't need to be afraid. I mean, how do you say that? How do you say don't be afraid if the world's literally falling apart around you? Psalm 103, verse 11, for as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his loving kindness toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. Just as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. Now, why am I sharing all this? Well, like I said, for the Christian, for the person who knows Christ, when we say fear God, this isn't just about being scared. I mean, you should have a healthy fear of God in the sense you should be scared that he is so great and mighty. But when we say we fear God, there is a tremendous blessing that comes in fearing God. Those who fear God experience his compassion, his loving kindness. You can rest secure when you fear God. Psalm 118, verse 6, the Lord is for me, I will not fear. What can man do to me? Right? I mean, if the Lord is for me, I don't need to be afraid. Now, some of you might have heard this story before, way back, but when my daughter Jenna was really young in elementary school, she said there was some boy picking on her at the bus stop. This was back in San Diego days. I think she was in like third or fourth grade at the time. So I said, okay, you tell me who it is. I'm going to walk with you to the bus stop. So the next morning, I dressed all in black. I wore my shades, and she said, it's that guy. So I walked up to him, and I was very calm. I didn't scream or yell. I just said, hey, is your name so-and-so? I heard you've been bothering my daughter and these other kids at the bus stop. You stop it, or I'm going to talk to your parents. You understand? I don't want to ever hear this again. I just walked away. And I was just laughing inside. Okay. And then later on, Jordan told me, like, all the kids cheered. And then the guy never bothered them again. And the point being this, I was like, hey, I'm your dad. You just tell me. Who messes with you, it's over. Okay, I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. That's still just a very vivid memory for me. One, because, I don't know, I felt like pretty good about that. I took care of my daughter. Protecting my daughter. Okay, it was just a fourth grade kid, but you know, still. And I still sometimes think that way. If someone's going to mess with someone who's precious to me, I'll take care of them. Now, I'm thinking that way in a very limited, very human, and even a very lame way. But think about if we belong to God, who's going to ultimately mess with us? No one can. I mean, the worst they can do is kill my body. But God can destroy both soul and body in hell. And if there's anyone who should fear God, it should be the one who has rebelled against him. That's why anyone here, if you're not a Christian, you know, and this sounds kind of harsh, but this is the reality of it. You cannot afford to take God lightly. You must understand that it's a fearful thing to face God as judge and final arbiter of justice. Just read the book of Revelation. And what does God do? He judges the entire earth. No one escapes his judgment. Everything will be revealed. Everyone will be designated either for blessing or for judgment. You know, maybe for those of us who wonder, will God vindicate? Will God show justice? Yes, he will. It just sometimes doesn't seem like it in our world today. Right, we look at our culture, we look at the government, we look at, you know, other countries, we see such injustice, we see, you know, just the crazy stuff that goes on, and we say, God, are you going to do anything about this? It seems like so many people get away with evil. Ecclesiastes 8:12 says this, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. You know, death comes to us all. I mean, what's the longest someone can live here on this earth? Maybe 100 or so years. That's a drop in the bucket compared to eternity. And when you think about that, and especially from the vantage point of justice and vindication, how much greater judgment is there for the one who has shaken his fist at God and who will suffer eternal condemnation for rejecting God, for sinning against him? And if there's one topic that Jesus talked the most about, it was about judgment and hell. You know, some people say, well, you're just trying to frighten us into heaven? No. This is the reality of dealing with sin. You see, this is what should bother all of us when we see sin running rampant. It bothers all of us. We don't like that. Why? Because we see what sin does. It destroys. So if you wonder, is God going to keep his word on judgment? Yes, he will. And you should be afraid, very afraid of that. That's why if you're not a Christian here, you are in a desperate place where you need to understand that the only one who can rescue you from condemnation is Jesus Christ. He is the one who takes the penalty for our sins on our behalf. He takes judgment on our behalf. That way, God's justice is still served. But God's grace and mercy have been manifested in that we have a Savior who can save us from our sin. Now, if you're a Christian, you need to remember this. This is a huge reminder as to why we don't seek vengeance on people. The people who sin against you will face much greater judgment from God. They will have to answer to God for everything that they do. And whether they're a Christian or not, they do have to answer to God. If they're not a Christian, they will suffer eternal condemnation. And the only thing that should elicit from you is you should have pity. And you should pray for mercy. Because as much as they might hurt you, that is nothing compared to facing eternal condemnation. As a Christian, I hope you would never, ever say in your heart to someone, "Go to hell." Do you even know what you're saying? Do you wish for someone to go to hell and stand in eternal judgment before God? Or are we not called to bring the message of the gospel even to those who sin against us and to extend the grace and mercy that we've been shown? So we shouldn't fear. We shouldn't fear those who could hurt you, those who could do evil against you, those who might even kill you, because God will exercise final judgment. But also do not fear, and this is in the last three verses 29 to 30, 31, remember God cares for you. Remember God cares for you. Look there in verse 29. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered, so do not fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. Back in those days, sparrows, they're little birds. And you could basically toast them up and have a little snack. And it cost like a cent. They weren't worth much. But then Jesus says here, these sparrows that are so cheap, you could buy two for a penny. Not a single one of them fall to the ground apart from God's knowledge. He cares for the birds. He knows what's happening with them. In fact, God knows the very hairs of your head. He knows the number of them. Even as they're falling out, He knows. I mean, you know, you think about it. Your hair. How many of you count your hairs every morning? What's the point of counting your hair, right? But God knows. So here's the deal. Do you not think that God cares more for you than the sparrows? Or how many hairs you have on your head? This kind of parallels Matthew 6, going back to verse 25. When Jesus says, "For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life?" What should be our response to all this? Don't be fearful, don't be anxious when people mistreat you. They did the same to Jesus. We're not any greater than our master, than our teacher. But remember, God cares for his children. God really cares. Now, I think that's a big lesson for me, you know, especially for Angela and I's parents, as we think about our daughters. Do you think we care about our daughters?
Please say yes.
Yes. We care about them. How much do we care about them? We care about them pretty much ever since They're an egg. And every step of the way along the way, got to take care of them every step of the way. And then when they pop out and they're helpless, and you got to change your diapers, you got to feed them, you got to do all this stuff. You got to care for every little need. And then when they're sick, I remember there was a time when Libby got pneumonia. And I remember we're crying. We're just crying around her. Why? Because we care. How much infinitely more does God care? But that's the question. Do you believe it? Do you believe God cares so much for you that even despite any suffering or any mistreatment that you might face, he promises to take care of you for eternity? Now, I've wrestled with that. I really have. I mean, every year, I would say it's the most difficult year, and every year there seems to be some person that I thought I could trust that backstabs and then goes about slandering and gossiping, and I'm thinking, like, why? I don't understand why. It makes me want to stop investing in people because I don't get it. You try to help people, and they turn that around and somehow just twist everything. So why do it? Why do it? Well, I can tell you why we can still do it. Because God cares. God cares, and we can trust him. And even these hardships and these difficulties, at the end of the day, we can see even how God uses those to accomplish his good purposes. We have to beware of our fear of man. This is our great weakness. We are so quick to give in to fear of man. When we fear man, our fear of God recedes. And when we fear man, we start to question God more. Because what are we doing? We're taking our eyes off of him. We're taking our eyes off of who he is. If you understand what the fear of the Lord means, you know, go to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 9:10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." It frames it that way so that we understand that all wisdom is grounded in this idea of fearing the Lord. Proverbs 14:26, "In the fear of the Lord there is strong confidence, and his children will have refuge." You know, you could be going through such crazy storms in life, and you wonder, what do I do? Right there. Fear the Lord. And in the Lord you will have confidence. You will find refuge in him. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life. Verse 27 there. That one may avoid the snares of death. Proverbs 16:6, "By loving kindness and truth, iniquity is atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil." Why is it so important to fear the Lord? Fearing the Lord is actually what keeps you away from evil. In fact, sometimes when someone does evil to us, we are tempted to do evil in return. And we feel justified because the other person did it first. You are never justified to do evil. Never. But in facing the struggle, right there, when you fear the Lord, you're able to keep away from evil. Proverbs 23:17, "Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always." You know, I think if we're honest, there are times where we envy sinners because they seem to get away with sin, right? But here it says, don't envy them. Do you understand where their ultimate end is? They have to face the righteous wrath of a holy God. Live in the fear of the Lord always. Now, when we talk about fearing the Lord, there is that sense where we should really be in awe of him. We should respect him. We should not treat him lightly. But we don't fear God in the sense that we are condemned. We fear God in the context of being loved by Him. We have a healthy fear of God, but it's not something that should be equated to how man uses fear as a weapon to manipulate others. You know, from a human vantage point, there is a sad reality that there are people who try to rule over others with fear. For example, parents who use fear and punishment as motivators, thinking that it will bring results. Now, yes, it will bring results. Why? Because what kid wants punishment? Well, some kids might say, forget it, I'll take it. But it definitely does not accomplish this. It doesn't perfect people in love. I mean, especially those of you who grew up in homes that fear was the greatest motivator. It was for me, right? You want a baseball bat, you know, to your backside? Get straight A's. Really? Like, that's how it works? I mean, even any perceived disobedience, you get beaten. Now, I have to admit, as much as I don't like that, I like instilling fear in my dog. Why? Because I want results. I want that dog to cooperate. You know, and I talk sweet to that dog. I hug the dog, pet him, feed him, you know. Well, you know what? Seems like he doesn't care. Takes it all for granted. So sometimes it's just like, sit. Sit. I use that sharp tone, serious tone. And he knows that tone. His tail stops wagging. It does. He'll look at me sort of hopefully at first. Like, you know, is it good? Is it good? I'm like, oh no. And then it's like. And that, see, this is where I'm confronted with this too in my own life. As much as I don't like being treated like that, it's so easy to treat other people like that. Okay, I try really hard not to do that to my wife and my kids. I do. I try not to do it. But I don't have any problem doing it with a dog. I don't know. You know, sometimes I'm wondering, like, is this why the dog is here? You know, it's just a constant reminder of my own sinfulness, and I got to work on things. If any of you would like to have that same lesson, let me know. You know, we can let you borrow our dog for a while. But here's the verse I want to end on. 1 John 4:18. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. And here's why I want to draw it to a close. The whole premise of what I've been getting at is this: discipleship is a commitment to loving Jesus. Everything that we do is motivated by a loving of Jesus. Why? Because he first loved us. And because he first loved us, we don't need to live in fear like man does. Why? Because we have been loved with a perfect love. That's why in Romans 8, remember when Paul says there's nothing that can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus? Not even death. What's the worst someone can do to you? Kill you. But nothing can separate you from the love of Christ. We have that perfect love. That's why Christians who have been martyred over all the centuries, they could face death without fear. Why? Because they know they're still loved. Nothing's going to take that away. Christ loves his children with an everlasting love. That's why when we say, what does it mean to be a Christian? It really comes down to this. I follow Christ because I love him. I love him because he first loved me. And that's enough. That's enough. I have all the motivation I need. I have all the resource I need. I am loved by Christ. So I can face whatever comes my way. Are you secure in the love of Christ? Do you have confidence that when Jesus says, I love you, that will never be taken from you? I want to ask you to bow your heads as we take communion. Or maybe some of you here this morning, again, if you don't know Christ, I really want to challenge you. Do you understand that God is a holy and righteous God who will judge sin? There's no way around that. We're all sinners. We will all face God's judgment. And you can't pin that on anyone else. You can't blame anyone else for what has happened. You and I have all chosen to willfully reject and rebel against God, our Creator. But God, being a merciful and gracious God, sent His Son to die on the cross on our behalf so that we would then trust Him alone, that His death would be sufficient, and that in rising again, we trust eternal life is found in Him. Will you trust Christ today? If you're a Christian here this morning, maybe you struggle with fear of men, just be reminded again how much God cares for you. He's already proven His love through the cross. Nothing can take that away from you.